Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Charles Murray. He holds the F.A. Hayek Emeritus Chair in Cultural Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and today we're going to talk about his latest book, Human Diversity: The Biology of Gender, Race, and Class. Dr. Murray, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
It's a pleasure to be on it.
Okay, so let's start with gender. So, do you differentiate between sex and gender? Is that something that you do in the book or not?
Well, in the United States, it technically refers to sex refers to biological differences, and gender refers to traits that can be culturally defined and so forth. I think it's pretty much a meaningless distinction anymore because we already know that there are very few traits that are completely culturally defined that separate men and women. So in the book, I just use sex. I don't have any strong feelings about not using gender. I just think it's pointless at this time.
And what about when people say people from certain areas of academia, like for example, the so-called cultural studies, like women's studies, for example, when they say that gender is a social construct, what do you think about that?
Well, it's easy to get roped into extreme statements on this kind of thing, Ricardo. Are there ways in which the culture has shaped male-female roles? The answer is definitely yes. Is there, however, a biological evolutionary substrate to those differences? And the answer to that is also yes. So I have no problem in talking about the role of culture in affecting male-female roles. What I refuse to deal with are people who say it's all culture, because to me that seems to ignore what we've learned about biology.
Right. And when it comes, for example, to gender roles and the fact that men and women tend to occupy different roles in society, isn't there a sort of chicken and egg problem here? Because, on the one hand, we could think that these gender roles are the result of psychological sex differences in terms of interests and personality and so on. Gender roles are the result of that, but on the other hand, it could be the case that gender roles come first and then influence the straight, right?
Okay, let's go back to the kind of the big differences that we can be quite confident are a product of evolution. Now, in the book, I actually don't deal with evolutionary psychology because in the United States, the women's studies groups will say, oh, that's just made-up stories that we have no way of knowing are true, and they're justifying these existing differences. I submit that just doesn't make sense in one major way, and that is with evolution, you succeed if you pass on your genes. All right? If you don't pass on your genes, you fail. And so you have had millions of years of evolution in which, now I'm talking about women and children, in which women who did not like babies and got angry and didn't want to care for them did not pass on their genes. The women who passed on their genes were ones who took care of babies, loved them, fed them, kept them clean. They passed on their genes. Now, to say that men and women have different relationships to small children because of culture just flies in the face of this huge evolutionary difference. Men could pass on their genes for millions of years simply by spreading their sperm to the widest possible number of women, and there's virtually unlimited. They didn't have to take care of babies in order for them to survive. They needed to have lots of offspring to maximize the chances. Those kinds of dynamics, those kinds of evolutionary dynamics, are so powerful that I think it makes the most basic difference between men and women, the most basic psychological difference, very understandable. And that most basic psychological difference is, well, it was first stated in 1904, and that is that men are more interested in things and drawn to things, and women are drawn to living things and to people. That's a very simple way of putting it. I think it explains an awful lot. It explains not just different child-caring roles. It explains different academic interests. It explains different vocational interests. And when we say, well, but couldn't it still be the culture that decisively affects this? I guess my response is, okay, if that's the case, when you take all of the many cultures around the world, radically different cultures, think of the difference between the way that women are treated in Saudi Arabia and the way they're treated in Sweden, okay? You know, hugely different social roles. If that's the case, we would also see very different personality profiles among women who've grown up in different cultures. That's not true. The commonalities in cross-cultural studies are quite striking, including in countries that are radically different in terms of their social, economic, and political institutions.
Mm-hmm. That last part that you mentioned is very interesting, because isn't it the case that when we study sex differences in personality and occupational and educational choices across societies, that we find that they are bigger in more gender equal countries?
Counterintuitive. You would predict exactly the opposite. Yes, and not only, this is not just something that has been observed in one study. It has now been observed, well, when I was working on the book, in three or four very large, very carefully conducted studies. So going back to the example of Saudi Arabia and Sweden, certain personality sex differences are more pronounced in Sweden than they are in Saudi Arabia. I actually think there's a fairly simple explanation for this. Let's not, Saudi Arabia is too extreme, but let's say you're talking about a poor country with very traditional treatment of women, but women in those countries also are under very severe cultural constraints, so that they have to modify their personalities in some ways to suppress what they would normally like to do, because that is not acceptable. In Sweden, or another country which has a very gender egalitarian set of policies, women are much freer to express themselves as they naturally would like to, and so those come out. In occupation, just one more example on this I find really interesting. Suppose you are a woman in Pakistan, and you have talent to be an engineer, or to go into chemistry. In Pakistan, there aren't that many jobs that are available that pay pretty well. So if you're trying to support your family, you have talent in chemistry, and chemistry pays pretty well, you may very well go into that because of the financial incentives. What you really want to do, let's say, is to be a teacher in elementary school, but you aren't going to do it because financial incentives are there to be the chemist. If you're in Sweden, same woman, same talents, she is much freer to become a teacher than the woman in Pakistan, because she has plenty of other economic ways of dealing with life than the woman in Pakistan does. It's a fascinating discovery. It's not one that anybody predicted, but I think it's understandable.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also important for us to talk a little bit about how we measure these differences. You also spend a good part of the book talking about statistics and how to interpret them. So, I mean, what are some of the more rigorous ways that we have of studying differences between men and women?
Well, rigorous is relative in this case. If you're talking about something like measuring intelligence, has a huge body of research behind it, and you can use rigorous. When it comes to personality traits, They have some good tests, and they pass statistical tests of reliability and validity. They are not on the same level of IQ tests in terms of the amount of rigor we can bring to the analysis. So with that as a caution, we have some pretty good tests of personality traits. They take behavior sometimes as the measure, so that suppose you're trying to measure warmth, then you would take a variety of things having to do with interactions with other people in terms of behaviors, or you can simply ask for their opinions. How important do you rate such and such a characteristic? How much would, on a scale of 1 to 5, how would you describe yourself as an introvert to extrovert? That kind of thing. And you end up with the ability to calculate effect sizes. And Ricardo, I do not want to get into a lot of the details here because it gets technical. But the short statement is that a lot of the individual differences are relatively small, but they also all hang together. So that they, well, I can give you some examples. I went to the book this morning just to, because I knew that I wasn't going to be able to remember all this stuff off the top of my head. But remember a minute ago I said that the hypothesis that men are interested in things and women are more interested in people. Well, here are some of the things, personality traits, that relate to that. All the traits I'm going to mention are ones in which women have considerably more of this than men. Warm, outgoing, attentive to others, sensitive, aesthetic, sentimental, cooperative and accommodating, altruistic, concerned for others, enjoys the company of others. These are all things which are consistent with the people things, discrimination between the two groups. And I will emphasize something now that is really important. We are talking about overlapping distributions, which means there are lots of men who have characteristics of warmth and cooperativeness and these traits that are identified with women. Lots of men are that way. Similarly, there are lots of women who have traits identified with men, but there is a difference in averages, and that's all it is. It should not be decisive in the way we deal with another individual human being.
And does that make any difference for the kind of thesis you're presenting in the book, the fact that we get these overlaps? Because some people bring that to the table when they're trying to discredit the literature on sex differences.
I'm so sorry, Ricardo. You mean they use what to discredit the
The fact that there's lots of
so much
overlapping
overlap?
between, yeah.
Yeah, the problem is that they make that case by using what in America we call a straw man. And that is, they say, look at all these people who say that men and women are binary and men are different from women. And here we can show that a lot of times men and women share the same characteristics. Nobody who is a serious scholar says binary men, binary women, there's no overlap between them. Nobody tries to make that case. It's the same problem you have with race differences and as you do with sex differences. The differences are not very important on an individual level. They have large social consequences. So that in the case of women, for example, you have these very large differences in participation in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And people are unhappy about that because that must mean that women are being prevented from getting into these fields because of cultural pressures. No, it's not necessarily the case. It can just as well be the case, and we have good evidence that it's the case, that the preferences of women, the deeply felt preferences of women, are different from the deeply felt preferences of men on average. And that produces large differences in vocational choices on a social society-wide level.
Does that have any implications in terms of how we think about social justice? I mean, are there, for example, certain goals that people who deal with social justice issues bring to the table that Perhaps we should have to change because of these biological sex differences.
Suppose that I am a man who is really drawn to mathematics, and I want to study mathematics and become a mathematics professor. Or suppose I'm a woman and I'm really drawn to biology and I want to study the biology of human beings. To me, social justice doesn't come into it. What I want is for the man to have a full chance to study mathematics and go as far as he can, and for the woman to study biology as far as she can, or vice versa. Suppose it's a woman who loves mathematics. A proper society will give her every opportunity to do that. But I would say that we're there in the United States, and I think probably throughout the EU, and I'm not an expert on the EU, certainly in many countries of the EU. Nobody is telling women or bringing social pressure on them not to study mathematics, as far as I know. It used to be true. It used to be true. I have an elder sister who went to college in the late 1950s and wanted to become an engineer. She's 18 years old. She's sitting in the classroom, and this professor stands up in front of the class and says he doesn't think women have any business being in engineering. That's pressure. That's social, cultural pressure. It did exist. I think it's pretty minor now.
So, I mean, the feminist revolution, for example, played an important role in bringing down some of those socio-cultural pressures.
So the feminist revolution was absolutely necessary. I have no reservations about that. However, as with so many other necessary changes, it brings collateral side effects. And some of the side effects of the feminist revolution were socially bad, but they were inevitable, and they have to be accepted as part of the price of getting women opportunities.
So, with all of this in mind, these sex differences, is it right to say that the stereotypes people hold about men and women are accurate, at least to some extent?
Sure. Even though you can't be certain that any woman you meet feels a certain way, I can say, people can say, men, women generally become more attached to their babies than the fathers do. The fathers may love the babies, they may spend a lot of time with the children, but there is often a deeper bond between, typically there's a deeper bond between the mother and a small child than the father. I think that's a fair statement, and it is likely to be true. If you, in other cases, the stereotypes statistically are definitely true. Autism, for example, is overwhelmingly a male disorder. So are Tourette's syndrome and dyslexia and other disorders. If you see it, if you talk about an autistic person and you refer to him when you're using an example of an autistic person, you're probably right. Similarly, women are more prone to depression, onset as adults, more prone to certain kinds of, well, bulimia and anorexia and so forth, which may have some cultural underpinnings, but they are also seem to be driven by things that are going on in the brain as well. So stereotypes of all kinds usually have an element of truth, and it varies from just a little bit to a whole lot.
So, to talk about race now, how would you define race? Because there's some dispute in, for example, anthropology and other social sciences about how race is defined.
Well, I think the geneticists have taken the right approach. The geneticists don't use the word race anymore. because race has so much baggage. It has so many emotional connotations that attach to it. They talk about populations, and they define those populations according to genetic variants. Genetic variants, which number in the hundreds of thousands. And using those, you can very closely specify what ancestry a person is likely to have. So you can not only distinguish whites from blacks from Asians, you can distinguish Portuguese from the English. A geneticist which takes a DNA sample from you and takes it from an English book can do it with pretty much 100% accuracy. And in the EU, do you have 23andMe, or do you have these commercial databases where you can send in a saliva sample and get back your ethnic background?
We
Yeah.
have, yes.
Okay. Well, that's what they're doing. They're using all of these variants to say you are 80% Portuguese ancestry and 15% English and 5% French. They can do that kind of thing. And the answer is race clearly defined, with blacks different from whites, different from Asians. No, there's overlap. Lots of overlap genetically. But are they also at the continental level, Europe versus Asia versus Africa, are those quite easily distinguishable genetically? Yes, they are. So it's like everything else. Race is outmoded in a way as a, if people want to talk about completely separate populations, it refers to something real, which is reflected in the fact that we can all, with 100% accuracy, discriminate between a person whose ancestors came from Nigeria, a person whose ancestor came from China, and people whose ancestors came from France.
But with the interbreeding that have been occurring between different human populations, is the concept of race still scientifically meaningful? Because, there are many people, particularly in anthropology, and some of them I've already interviewed, who say that race is not a scientific concept, a scientifically validated concept.
Well, and I'm in a sense, I agree. And I'm going to use the ancestral population. But if they say, well, ancestral population, there's too much mixing to tell Africans apart from Asians, that's just wrong. Now, the United States has more racial intermixing of blacks and whites than most countries have because of the era during slavery, especially. But even so, the best estimates now are that you take an American who self-identifies as African American, and genetically, he's about 86% African. There is an admixture from white and from American Indians, but 86% is a lot. And in the case of people who self-identify as whites from Northern Europe, it's 98%. So, and with Asians, it's virtually 100%. So, has there been some mixing going on? Of course there has. Does that prevent the distinctions from being important? No, it doesn't prevent that. And this surfaces in some ways that should bother us a lot. We know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Asians respond to some kinds of medical treatments differently from Africans. Africans respond differently from Europeans. Some things that work with one population don't work with another population. Sometimes the doses of a medicine should be different. The only way you're going to know that is by studying differences in ancestral populations carefully. You don't have any choice but to study it.
Right. But these racial categories, would they correspond exactly to the different races that people identify in society? Because We could also argue that perhaps, I mean, when people talk about blacks and whites and Hispanics and so on, the people they identify with those races are not really the same groups that we would identify in science.
Well, with Hispanics, you've got a real problem, yes. With blacks and with whites, as I just indicated, in the United States, no, they're pretty clean in terms of if you've got 86% on average African ancestry, if you self-identify as black, that's pretty clean. 98% is really clean. Hispanics are way different because in the United States, I actually prefer the word Latino because Hispanic is too directly connected with Iberia, the peninsula. And in fact, Latinos are their only unifying characteristic is they come from Latin America. So that means that they can be genetically all the way from 100% Portuguese. In Brazil, there must be some who are still 100%. Or 100% from Spain, from Mexico, and so forth. But you can also go to those that are 100% from a pre-Columbian American tribe, the Mayan Indians, or other kinds of tribes. Or, and this is very common, they can be mestizo, which in the United States is a term used for someone who is a mixture of European and Native American ancestry. And they've been intermarrying now for 3 or 4 centuries. And so that's almost a distinctive, it's certainly a distinctive ethnic group. So I'm not happy doing genetic generalizations about the group we call Latino in the United States because they're just too different. That's not true of blacks and whites and Asians.
Right. And when we talk about race differences, does that include psychological differences? Are there any major psychological differences between races?
The first answer is that we are going to find out, but we don't know a lot yet. And this is something that I think we need to be concerned about. Geneticists are in the process of decoding the genome so that we have learned what tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of genetic variants do in some general sense. We know that here are 1,000 genetic variants that are associated with cognitive ability. Here are 1,000 genetic variants that are associated with depression. You can go on. All right. Now, we are still at the beginning of that process of understanding what individual variants do to affect human beings. But we already do know that there are substantial differences in the presence of these variants and their frequencies in different populations. That is, we don't know exactly what they mean yet, but we do know that the differences exist. So that people who say there are no important psychological or cognitive differences between Asians and Europeans and Africans, that's a very dangerous position to take. Because we already have very good reason to think it's just not true. And the problem is, if you say that, you can get in big trouble. In the United States, one of the most prominent geneticists, highly respected geneticists, is a man named David Reich at Harvard, who has made his name by studying ancient DNA, which, by the way, is a fascinating study of, I mean, it's just wonderful in reconstructing European history, for example, what we've learned from ancient DNA. But David Reich, who politically is a man of the left, has said, look, we are going to discover some genetic differences across the groups that we have in the past called races. We don't need to be afraid of that. It's not going to be a disaster, but they exist. And he attracted huge criticism for just saying that. I'm afraid in this regard, we are putting our heads in the sand and refusing to confront a reality that sooner or later we have to confront.
But when it comes to studying psychological differences between groups, one of the tools that we have is behavioral genetics. But I mean, I've talked with some behavioral geneticists on the show, and they tell me that, in fact, this discipline is not that good in terms of uncovering group differences, because it is basically about studying variation, individual variation within a given population in a particular environment. So, I mean, do you take into account what comes from behavioral genetics? And if not, what would be your other sources?
Well, this is the kind of thing we're going to be able to study, because we have, let's say that we are talking about, everybody knows the most sensitive area is Africans versus Europeans. And so Africans grow up in all kinds of different cultural and economic environments, from those who grow up in wealthy homes and attend the best colleges to those that live in impoverished villages in sub-Saharan Africa, and everything in between. They grow up in places like Europe, they grow up in the United States. Similarly, among Europeans, you have them with a huge range of backgrounds. Great, you have, from a scientific perspective, you collect very large samples, and by large, I mean hundreds of thousands, of whites and blacks, and you have variables that characterize their upbringing, their economic situation, their social situation, also their cognitive abilities as measured by mental tests, their personality characteristics. If you have big samples like that and you have a good understanding of the genetics of these traits, you can disentangle the role of genes from the role of environment. It will not be an easy task, but analytically, it is within our capability, and we're starting to do it right now. It's already happening. Over the course of this decade, my own assumption is that the practice of the social sciences is going to be transformed by this new knowledge. That unless by 2030, I'm going to be very surprised if you can publish a technical article in a major academic journal on the effects of socioeconomic status on income without also taking the genetic characteristics of your sample into account. I think that by 2030, you can't get it published, because everybody will say, did you control for genetics? And if you didn't, we aren't going to pay any attention to your results. I may be wrong. There are a couple of well-known psychologists who are adamant that I'm wrong. I'd be willing to bet money.
Okay, so before we talk about class, do you still stand by what you presented in the bell curve back in the 90s when it comes to race differences in IQ?
Sure. there's been no reason to back off in the slightest. The only thing that I would add is that we were riding the bell curve in the early 1990s. And there was evidence at that time that the size of the difference in IQ between blacks and whites had been shrinking. And we reported that evidence, but we also saw signs that the shrinking had stopped and it had leveled out. And so we had a very cautious conclusion. We said, you know, there's some good news out there in that it has shrunk. There's some other news that's less positive and that it may have leveled off. So we suggest everybody just wait and find out how this plays out. And as of 2021, we know better how it played out. You had a significant shrinking of the black-white difference in IQ scores from the early 1970s to the late 1980s. And since then, it's been quite flat. That's 40 years now, or 30 some years that it's been flat. So that's the thing I would add to the bell curve. Also in the bell curve, which became infamous because people said that Dick Ernstein and I said that the differences were genetic. We didn't actually say that. We said in one paragraph that after presenting the evidence for environmental explanations and the evidence for genetic explanations, we said, we still don't know. We think it's very likely that both are involved to some extent, but we don't know how much. That's all we said then. Now I would make a stronger statement. I would say, now we know that some significant proportion of the differences on many of these traits is likely to be genetic, but we still are a very long way from pinning down how much and exactly how it works.
Okay, so talking about class now, what is the relationship between heritability and class? Is class heritable?
It always has been heritable to some degree. The reason being this. We know that a variety of traits that are very important to success in life, different kinds of abilities, are heritable. Maybe 30%, 40%, 50%. It varies according to the trait, but it is somewhat heritable. And if that's the case, you will tend to have children from successful families have ability that they then pass on and results in continued membership of an upper class. Gregory Clark, a British, I guess he's a psychologist or historian, I'm not sure which, has written a number of books tracing English families back hundreds of years and pointing out the ways in which class is very sticky in ways that can't be explained across generations, in ways that can't be explained just by the aristocratic system they had. But the situation has gotten much worse in the last 100 years in advanced countries, and that's what the bell curve was about. Around the middle of the 20th century, their IQ became a lot more valuable in the marketplace. The new technologies that were developed meant that there were jobs for people who formerly could only be mathematics professors. There were jobs for them as programmers, as analysts for quantitative hedge funds, where they could make lots and lots of money, which didn't exist before. But even in other occupations, intellectual ability became monetarily much more valuable. I'll give you an example, is attorneys, lawyers. You know, in 1950, if you were a lawyer, you made a good living, you were in the upper middle class, you were not fabulously wealthy because simply the kinds of legal cases you handled did not make you wealthy. Now, if you are a really brilliant lawyer who can negotiate a multinational merger worth hundreds of billions of dollars, you are worth a lot of money. If you are capable of doing that, and part of the ability to do that is intellectual. So, across a wide range of occupations, you had IQ and income become more tightly linked. And also, people with similar levels of ability started to marry each other. So, you know, when 1940, a successful man probably married a woman that he met in his community who was not particularly chosen because she was really smart. In 2021, and actually this has been true for 30 or 40 years, that same guy is going to marry a woman who is also has her law degree from Harvard or her medical degree from Yale and is really, really smart. And so the whole process of transmitting class has gotten much more intensified, certainly in the United States, which I know the most about, but I think it's also happened in Europe.
So this assortative mating you're talking about Could it be one of the factors driving economic inequality?
Absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of this is driven as well by new technology, so that these huge fortunes that have been made in information technology would not have been possible in the same way from, before 1960, 1970. It's driven partly by that, but also partly because the marginal value of ability has gotten greater. So that it didn't make that much of, go back to a time when everybody was a farmer, when 90% of the people were farmers. Were the smart farmers probably somewhat more successful than the dumb farmers? Yeah, probably somewhat. But that was a fairly small difference in income. And so you had a lot more equality in poverty because it just wasn't that valuable to have that extra talent. That same farmer who's smart is no longer a farmer. He's gone off and become a physician or an architect or something like that, and is making lots more money. So, yeah, it's been a main driving force.
So you mentioned IQ. Apart from IQ, what are some of the other traits, psychological ones in this case, that are associated with success? Would it include things like conscientiousness, for example?
Especially conscientiousness. There are different labels that are given for these traits. In the United States, we have emotional intelligence, that is, refers to interpersonal skills, and also to some extent things like self-discipline. There's another concept called grit in the United States, which is perseverance and resilience and all of these things, which are extremely important. Extremely important. You can have a lot of perseverance and resilience and self-discipline and conscientiousness, but you still cannot become a physicist unless you have a high level of intellectual ability. There are, for every occupation, these personality traits are very important to distinguish the success among people within the same occupation. But across occupations, the intellectual ability is more important than the other traits.
Right. And so, do you have any sort of solutions or interventions that we could make to deal with these issues surrounding economic inequality and class and things like that?
Boy, if I did have solutions, I would have told you about them a long time, or told the world about them a long time ago. The big problem here, I think, is this mistaken idea, driven by the upper class, actually, that everybody ought to want to become successful in the same way, so that you become a physician or an attorney or an engineer, or you have a relatively small number of professions that have a lot of prestige, and that if people can't be those things, they must be miserable. Well, that's just not true. I know lots of miserable lawyers. They went into the law because they wanted to make a lot of money, but they hate the law. I know lots of very fulfilled, satisfied craftsmen, people who are not engaged in an occupation that has a lot of prestige, but they're making a pretty good income. Electricians and plumbers make good money in the United States, and they're also doing something that they're good at and they enjoy doing it. So the first thing that I think you need to have the elites do is to quit looking down on people who are engaged in these kinds of occupations. Quit feeling as if you're superior to them, because you aren't. In terms of human worth, you certainly aren't. And if anybody tries to tell me that a college professor is more valuable to society than a plumber, I just won't agree with them. Because we can get along without the college professors, we can't get along without the plumbers. And the same goes for a wide variety of other people. So my solution is not really a solution. It is trying to talk to people who are on the top of society and get them to do a couple of things. One is to recognize the degree to which they were just lucky. Nobody earns his IQ. I don't care whether it's matter, genes, or environment. The environment is not determined by you. It's determined by the family you were born into. And the genes certainly aren't your choice. If you are lucky enough to have a high IQ in 2021, you ought to be on your knees every night giving thanks that you were so lucky, because it had nothing to do with you. So I want to see some humility there. And I also want to stop this business of people thinking that they must, particularly the upper middle class, that they should live in a neighborhood that exists completely of people like them. And I'm trying to get the word out. Life is much more interesting and richer if you are engaged with a wide variety of people, if you're living in a real community with real problems to be solved. These aren't solutions in the usual sense of the word.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, the science you present in the book about human diversity when it comes to race, class, and gender, do you think that it goes associated with any particular kind of political ideology? Because some people unfortunately say that perhaps it's something that goes associated with the far right, for example.
There is actually a natural connection between the findings in something like human diversity or the bell curve. There's a natural connection between that and social democracy and redistribution. And the natural link is that if people are successful for reasons that are not their own merit, they were just lucky, then it's unjust that you have unequal distribution of things. John Rawls is the philosopher, of course, who is most famous for his theory on this. There's a natural connection there. And that's at the left. And in The Bell Curve, Richard Herrnstein, my co-author, and I recognized that. And we said, we're going to spend a chapter telling you why we disagree. And for us, we said, look, the important thing, it has nothing to do with equality per se. It has to do with people being able to find what we call valued places in society. And that means places that if you weren't there, you would be missed. And that could be true because you are a parent with children. It can be true because you've been a good neighbor. It can be true because of your occupation. But we said that you ought to organize society so it generates large numbers of valued places. That is inherently conservative, because what it really says is societies need to be constructed in a way where communities still have a lot of responsibility for what goes on. You can't try to run everything from the central capital and make all these rules and regulations. That's the kind of thing that strips individuals of valued places. And so we tried to make that case. The problem with the far right link is if you take race differences, let's say, in IQ, and you say, well, that means blacks are inferior to whites. And that's what the white supremacists argue. They, in order to make that claim, they have to ignore the facts about overlapping distributions and the rest of it. Can they use that as propaganda for their position? Sure. In the same way that the far left uses an overemphasis on environmental conditions to say, oh, if we just rip up society and reconstruct it in a socialist within society, we can solve all these problems. Both the far left and the far right live in a fantasy world where neither one is recognizing important truths that conflict with their ideology. I'm angry at both of them.
Okay, so let me just ask you about one last topic. Why do you think that there are so many people in the social sciences that are not really that fond of these literature when it comes to race differences, gender differences, etc.?
Well, I've thought about that for a long time. Part of it is the ideological emphasis on equality that is very prevalent throughout Europe, and is certainly very prevalent in academia in the United States. And for reasons I just explained a little bit, I think that emphasis on equality is misplaced. But it's there, and there are lots and lots of people who think not just that equality and rights is important. In the United States now, we have this very vocal, passionate advocacy for equal outcomes. And you want to, and it goes under the guise of the accusations of systemic racism, and we must use the power of the state, to equalize outcomes no matter what. Now, that is attractive to the left. And it's a case where I say to myself, it shouldn't be that attractive to the left, but the reality is that it is. And I will add to that, at this point, I'm getting very much into my own suspicions. I don't have good evidence for this, but I've known a lot of people in academia. And one of the characteristics is that they, first place, they're secular. They're not religious at all. And by being secular, they have lost one of the most important virtues of Christianity. And that is, Christianity has as a very fundamental truth that we are all frail, we are all sinners in the eyes of God. We all have access to the grace of God, but not because of what we do. It's a free gift to us. It was a good way to keep people humble. If they were conscious of, God does not care if you have an IQ of 130 versus an IQ of 90. He does not think you are a better person if so that's gone. So they're secular. They also, academics, what is the one human trait that they are most obsessed about in themselves? How smart they are. The same people who will tell you, oh, IQ is meaningless and so forth, they are obsessed with comparing themselves with their colleagues in the university faculty as to are they as smart as the other people? And I think an awful lot of them really do confuse being smart with being superior. I think that makes them feel guilty toward people who aren't as smart as they are. I think it makes them feel sorry for people who aren't as smart as they are. And I would like to introduce them to a lot of my friends where I live who aren't nearly as smart as they are, and who probably are aware that in a pure IQ sense, they aren't as smart as a college professor. They don't care. They do not feel inferior to the college professor in any way, and they're right not to feel inferior. But it is true that among intellectuals, there is an enormous sense of, I'm really smart, and everybody who's not as smart as me must feel inferior. It's wrong, but an awful lot of them have it. I think they have that kind of unconscious mindset. I could be completely wrong. I don't have hard data on this. It sure is consistent with a lot of the conversations I've had with people about the bell curve over the last 27 years.
But isn't it the case that at least some of these differences could be used by the left, for example, to make a very good case about helping people that are born with certain traits that, for example, lead them to be in a lower socioeconomic position?
It can be used by the left for that, not for the reasons I've just stated, but for that matter, I am in favor of a universal basic income that is given to everybody over the age of 21. and one that is large enough to enable people to live a comfortable existence. And part of my reason for being in favor of that is because I'm so conscious of the degree to which we live in a society now in which good luck regarding mental capacities has become so important. So I don't think that's a monopoly of the left. I think we all have to come to grips with that. Now, it's not whether we help those who are less fortunate. I think part of being a thoughtful human being is to feel that obligation, no matter what your politics are. But the politics of the left goes way beyond that. It not only wants to use the power of the state to make life better for people who've been unlucky, they want to use the power of the state to force society into a form that they think is just and correct, and they don't care how many eggs they have to break to produce that. And I think that's very dangerous.
Okay, so let's end on that note. Again, the book is Human Diversity, The Biology of Gender, Race, and Class. Dr. Murray, just before we go, where can people find your work on the internet?
Well, they can find Human Diversity at Amazon, of course, as always. But if they go to aei.org, which is the website of the institute I work for, they can pull up the articles I've written going back 30 years. So my work is very easily accessible on the internet. Or for that matter, if they're interested in other things, YouTube, you Google me on YouTube, and you'll pull up a lot of lectures that you can watch if you want to.
Dr. Murray, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for coming on the show.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've been doing the channel for more than 3 years now, and it is thanks to people like you that it's been running for so long. And so, if you like what I'm doing, please pay a visit to my Patreon page or to PayPal. All of the links are in the description box of the interview. And to consider making a pledge there, support the show. And otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share the interview, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Per-Helge Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Fredrik Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Kessel, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arnaud Wolf, Tim Hollesy, Henry Kalanias, John Connors, Paulina Baron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Koh, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Fergal Kussen, Yevhen Bodrenko, Al Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Özlem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacila Dez Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Miren B., Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Max Bailby, Nelek Bak, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Horowitz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Ellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Saima Afzal. My producers is Arwebi, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafinha, Kian Gilligan, Sérgio Quadriano, Luís Caetano, Tom Venegdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardus France, and Niruban Balachandran. And my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie James Pratt, and Matthew Lavender. Thank you for all.